Welcome to The Reference Desk, a podcast where two librarians take you down the rabbit hole of the topics that have bewitched us.
So adjust the chain on your reading glasses, button up your favorite cardigan, and follow us punk-ass book jockeys through the stacks to The Reference Desk.
Welcome to The Reference Desk.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Haley.
And we're so happy you're here.
Yay! Yay! Thank you for joining us today, this evening. I don't know.
Whenever you're listening to this.
You know.
What's going on with you?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if this had happened last time we recorded. Yeah, I had gotten kittens by then, the last time we recorded.
I think so.
I had them. But that's just, they're taking over everything, which is great. It's super fun. And it's the holidays, so that's happening.
It is.
Oh, Finn is out of school. He has been, whew. He's a different species right now. I don't know what's going on with him. He is so hyper.
Well, he's out of his routine.
Yeah.
It's the holidays.
Whew. I love that you sent the video of Rory singing today. That was fantastic. I tried to take one of Finn singing one of his Christmas songs, but mm-hmm. he has like changed all of the words to Jingle Bells. So it's like dashing through the snow. Jingle Santa.
Oh.
Okay. Just throw Santa in whenever you're, you know, unfamiliar.
Mm. Rory stayed with my parents last night, and when we went to pick her up today, we went into the house and they were like, don't come upstairs yet, we're just finishing rehearsals. And then we went up and she sang Last Christmas.
Oh, which great. Is
for some reason her favorite Christmas song.
Amazing. I love it so much.
But she only knows the chorus, so
sure,
of course, you know, she just sang that 3 times in a row and that's the
perfect
song.
Perfect. No, nothing's really been going on. TikTok shop got me. It got me. I don't know if you have all of the ads for the walking pads, the little mini treadmills.
No.
Okay. Well, they were like all over the place on my TikTok shop. And so I got one. And it is fantastic.
Is it?
Yes. I just put it in my living room because it's so small. It slides under the couch. Ooh. And I just walk while I'm watching TV. It's wonderful.
Does it like move?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a treadmill. Yeah.
Do you plug it in or is it like your body that moves?
No,
it?
You plug it in. It's electric. Okay. There's like a little remote so you can like change everything because it's just like a flat pad. I think you can also put them like under your desk or if you have like a standing desk or whatever. So there's like no bar or anything, but it's, you know.
God, I would be afraid I would trip and fall.
I was a little scared at first, but it's great. So,
Okay.
That's all I've been doing in the exactly 30 minutes I have between Finn bedtime and my bedtime. So, hooray.
Oh.
What have you been up to?
Gosh, you know, I'm not going to lie. I've been having a hard time. As you know, my dog passed away a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And like, I miss her so much. But I've also really come to realize that like, I depended on her a lot for keeping me in a routine.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she woke me up every morning at the same time.
Right.
And, like, throughout the day, you know, like, she would, like, let me know, like, okay, like, we need to go outside. It's time to go for a walk. And, and like, at 5 o'clock, it was, like, time to feed me. Uh-huh. And then even, like, she had a bedtime. Like, if it was 10 o'clock and I was still, like, downstairs working, she would just start barking at me until I would take her and put her in bed.
Aww.
So now, like, without her, I just feel, like, very lost. So definitely just, like, struggling to be productive and just remember, like, silly things. Like, okay, I should probably maybe eat something.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no one to remind me.
Oh, that's really hard.
I know. I told Dave, I'm like, I don't think I even realized it while she was here, but she was like my ADHD support animal.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. Aw.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. It's hard.
Yeah, definitely. You had her forever.
Yeah, 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I know. And we lost my family dog like 3 weeks before that, and he was almost 18, which is just insane. So my parents are going through like that same thing of like, oh, we don't have a dog to come home to.
Yeah.
Strange.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have one dog, but Gatsby is very much Dave's dog.
Aww. Gatsby.
Yeah. So anyways, on to happier things. Are there any?
I don't know. Not in this episode.
Well, what's your staff pick this week?
Sorry. Yeah, so my staff pick, I think I may have talked about watching Maid on Netflix, either to you or on the podcast. I'm not positive, but I started the limited drama series Maid a while ago, and then I paused because it was a little intense I was feeling feelings. Mm-hmm. So I stopped, and then I just picked it up again. It's phenomenal.
It's so good.
Oh gosh, it's so amazing. So if you're unfamiliar, Maid is a limited drama series on Netflix based on the memoir of the same name written by Stephanie Land. And as much as I love the show, it was heartbreaking, it was beautiful, and everyone should watch it. But I am recommending the memoir this week as my staff pick because I just finished that one. It was phenomenal. Of course, different than the show, but I mean, all book-to-movie adaptations are.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to read the blurb for the memoir. The full title is Maid, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. At 28, Stephanie Land's plans of breaking free from the roots of her hometown in the Pacific Northwest to chase her dreams of attending a university and becoming a writer were cut short when a summer fling turned into an unexpected pregnancy. She turned to housekeeping to make ends meet, and with a tenacious grip on her dream to provide her daughter the very best life possible, Stephanie worked days and took classes online to earn a college degree and began to write relentlessly. Maid explores the underbelly of upper middle class America and the reality of what it's like to be in service to them. I'd become a nameless ghost, Stephanie writes about her relationships with her clients, many of whom do not know her from any other cleaner, but who she learns plenty about. As she begins to discover more about her clients' lives, their sadnesses, and love, she begins to find hope in her own path. So I remember reading Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich in either high school or college. I don't remember which. Did you ever have to read that?
No.
It's so good. She's either like a nonfiction writer or a journalist. I'm not positive which one, but she, in I believe either the 90s or the early 2000s, decided that she was going to try to live for 30 days on minimum wage.
Hmm.
And so, you know, she had to find housing, she had to find all of this stuff just on minimum wage. And so she describes, you know, how absolutely difficult that is. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. And this reminded me a lot of that. I think there's such a big stigma around, you know, people who take any form of government assistance and, mm-hmm. you know, they're just leeching off the system and all of this. But it can't be further from the truth. Like,
right.
It is so hard to get government assistance. There are so many hoops you have to jump through just to prove that you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrific. So Stephanie did a fantastic job of describing all of that, and really just her love for her daughter is kind of what pushes her through everything. And she also reads the audiobook, which I listen to it by audio, and she's really good.
Oh, I love it when the author reads it.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. So highly, highly recommend both the show and the memoir. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I watched the show. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the memoir though. But yeah, the show, I watched like the first episode and then had to take a break because I was like, oh, wow, this is way heavier than I was expecting.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's really good.
So there's a scene. I don't know if you remember. this might be a spoiler if anyone's going to read it. I don't know. But she ends up in a home for like domestic violence. It's
a woman's shelter.
Shelter. That's it. Shelter. So she ends up in a women's shelter and she is completely like dazed and out of it. You know, it's super stressful. And so she doesn't leave the little apartment that she's in. And someone brings them food and sets it outside their door. And she brings it inside. And when she opens her daughter's, it's like pancakes with smiley faces and stuff on it. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, it was that moment that I lost it. Aww. I cried for like 10 minutes. I could not stop. But it's so, so good.
It is. Yeah. Yes.
Do you have a staff pick?
I do. So my number one recommendation right now is to call or email your representative and demand a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the state of the war will be when this episode comes out, but regardless of when this comes out, the people of Gaza will still need our help.
Absolutely.
So keep calling and emailing. I have gotten into a lovely little back and forth with my rep, who must not get a lot of correspondence because his area is like us and the Upper Peninsula. So either him or someone on his staff is like actually emailing me back.
Okay.
So like he emails me and tells me like all the reasons why we are not going to do a ceasefire. And then I email him back and like refute all of his points. And then he emails me back. It's great. I mean, like, at least he or someone in his office is responding, and
sure,
I can only hope that eventually it helps change his mind.
Yeah.
Anyways, in addition to doing that and like trying to find other ways to like keep my sanity and feel like I'm doing anything productive when I'm literally like thinking about the people in Gaza from the moment I open my eyes to the moment I go to sleep.
Yeah.
I've been trying to include more books by Palestinian authors into my reading. And I just recently finished Salt Houses by Hala Alian. And it's a multi-generational story that follows a Palestinian family through 1967 up basically through present day. And this family loses their home during the Six-Day War in 1967 and is displaced. And it follows their struggle to rebuild some semblance of hope and remain tied to their culture while they're basically just displaced again and again through these, I think it's three generations, because of these different conflicts in the Middle East. And the thing that like kept making me kind of like sit up in shock again and again while I was reading it is that like this family is one of the lucky ones. They're able to relocate and rebuild their lives in some way because of the relative privilege that they have. Mm-hmm. And yet like the trauma that they endure is so profound and so long lasting. And I think that this would be a really good one to read, like in conjunction with learning more about the history of the past 50-ish years. Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of it, as I'm reading it, it's like this took place during my lifetime. And yet, like, I had no idea that this was going on. So it's a really good look at like how those events that we experienced, like 9/11 and like the fall of Saddam Hussein and all of that, you know, were impacting people on the other side of the world. Even the ones who were privileged had, you know, it's just.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe it will inspire us all to think about how far reaching and long lasting the consequences of the current events that are happening now are and will be for generations and generations and generations.
Yeah.
So anyways, not a happy read. There's still like a lot of like resilience and the family is really beautiful. They're incredibly flawed, but, you know, are obviously need each other to get through this. So, yeah, that was a good one.
Great.
Yeah, it's a heavy time that we're living in.
Yes. Yeah. Again, like, I think this is probably going to go up in January.
Mm-hmm.
But it is mid-December right now.
So keep calling, keep emailing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Keep talking about it.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, it's just all downhill from here. I'm sorry.
Great.
I guess that could be kind of a happy-ish ending to this one. There is an ending. I'll say that. I mean, there's an ending. Okay, so as I'm sure you know, one of the frustrations with ADHD is that we are completely dopamine driven and we cannot do a thing about it. So it's finally settling in just how much I am dopamine driven. Even as I was reading, you know, the staff pick that I was talking about, Made, I picked that book up 4 times in the last year and just couldn't get into it at all, just because I was just not in the mood. I picked it up last week and I could not put it down. Like, I was completely immersed and devoured it. And I was kind of feeling similar about all of the topics that I have half episodes written for. I kept writing and then I lost interest. And it's not that they're bad topics. I'm just not interested in them right now.
Yep.
So it was taking me forever. But then I found this. So I'm going to kind of throw in another staff pick because I am just completely bewitched with this thing. And I want everyone to watch it so that I can talk about it. Tom and I just finished Yellow Jackets. Have you watched Yellow Jackets?
I have not.
Oh my God. Okay. So it is a Showtime show. There's 2 seasons. Season 3 is, I think, set for next year. So it is happening. Oh gosh. Okay. So it's been a while since anything has hooked me like this. I have just gone down like rabbit hole after rabbit hole. Ugh.
It's one of those shows that, like, I hear everyone talking about, but because, like, so many people are talking about it, I'm like, I'm not watching that.
Yeah, it took me a while to watch it. It's been on my list for a little bit, and we finally just decided to do it because we had a pass for Showtime for the month or something. Mm-hmm. So it's about a high school soccer team in the 90s. They're on their way to nationals when their plane crashes in the Canadian wilderness. And so it goes back and forth between their time in the wilderness, what they had to do to survive, female friendships, and then it goes back into some of them who did survive as adults and all of the trauma that it is bringing up, all of the lies that they have to tell to everyone close to them because they had to do some pretty messed up stuff to survive. The acting is stupendous. Like, it is so good. So Christina Ricci's in it. She's phenomenal. Juliette Lewis is in it. She's great. All of the actors who play the younger versions of the girls, so the girls in the woods, are just stunning. And they're all, I think, like up-and-comer new actors. Mm-hmm. And they are just going to – they have to go places because they were so good. Oh, man. It's just – you know, it's got drama. It's got a survival story. It's possibly got some supernatural ritualistic stuff going on. There's murder mystery. And it does that thing that I like where it's like, is what's happening supernatural or is it something else? Okay. I love that. Yeah. It's so good. So during my deep dive of the show, as I was like digging into it more and more, I discovered that it is loosely based on 2 historical events.
Getting really excited.
So the first event is actually one that I have done before, a very long episode, and that is the Donner Party. Mm-hmm. And the second is the true survival story of Uruguay. Oh gosh, I looked up how to say Uruguay so many times because it's not Uruguay. It's we say Uruguay, but I can't say it the Spanish way. I can't do it.
Okay.
It's like Uruguay, I think.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to say Uruguay.
Okay.
Okay. So this is the true survival story of the Uruguayan rugby team whose plane crashed in the Andes Mountains in an area, you know, with no vegetation, no animals, only snow, essentially uninhabitable. So I figured, you know, I'd cover all my bases and make sure that I had an episode on both source material. And that's why this week I am bewitched by the 1972 crash of Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571.
Oh my gosh. Oh, this has been on my list forever. I'm so excited.
Okay.
Okay. I listened to, I can't remember if it was just a really long one or a two-part episode about this on You're Wrong About.
Mm.
And I was just like, oh my God, it's is the craziest story. I'm so excited.
Okay.
Okay. These children are, oh my God, phenomenal.
I don't understand it. I would just be dead in 5 minutes because I would be like, I don't know what to do.
I'm so excited.
Okay. So on October 13th, 1972, a chartered, now I can't say Uruguay anymore.
Archipelago.
I'm just going to say Uruguay. That's how I've said just it my whole life. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's wrong. I know. Okay, so the chartered Uruguayan Air Force flight carrying the Old Christians Club, which was a rugby union club from Montevideo, Uruguay, was on its way to Chile. So I had a small fascination of this event when I was way too young to have a small fascination of this event. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, in my memory, it was always a football team, like non-American football, soccer. I guess because I kind of just equated football in Latin America with how, like, American football is in America. It's like,
sure,
the sport of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of always wondering, like, you know, why rugby? I don't get that. But it turns out, like most things, kind of has to do with religion a little bit.
Okay.
So exactly who brought the sport to the nation is a matter of debate. According to their account, the game was initially played in Uruguay by the British schools of Montevideo. Mm. And so when the Spanish colonized Uruguay, of course, evangelization soon followed. In the 1800s, the capital city of Uruguay, which is Montevideo, was established as a Catholic diocese. There, you know, missionaries followed the pattern of gathering all the natives into communities and training them in agriculture and husbandry and, of course, forcing Catholicism on them.
Mm-hmm.
So Catholicism became the faith of everyone. And in fact, in the 1830s, the Constitution officially made Catholicism the religion of the state.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
So they were, I mean, and they still are real Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And so lots of Catholic organizations began popping up, including lots of schools from all over. You know, people were coming to Uruguay to make Catholic schools. And so in the 1950s, many upper-class Catholics near the capital expressed some dissatisfaction with the public school system and worries about the religious instruction their kids would receive. So in an attempt to establish a school for boys in the upscale Carrasco district, they approached the Congregation of Christian Brothers, which was a religious community established in Ireland in the 1800s, and they had been expanding across the world. So they were now in Uruguay. They were setting up schools, and the rich people around Montevideo was like, ooh, pick us. And the Christian Brothers said, sure. And they established the Christian Brothers College of Montevideo, or what is commonly referred to as Stella Marie College, in 1955. Okay. And of course, they brought their love of rugby with them. And they definitely played a very large role in popularizing the game in Uruguay. In 1962, they officially founded the Old Christians Club at the school, which was a rugby union. And with time, rugby games gained popularity, and the Old Christians Club welcomed new members every summer who offered a greater selection of players and an improved team, eventually becoming one of the best teams in the country. In 1968, they won the Uruguayan National Championship.
Oh, wow.
And then they won it again in 1970. And of course, wanting to go further, in 1971, they traveled to Argentina to play teams there and did so well that they set their sights on Chile. So they were about 50-50 in their games in Chile. They, you know, won half, lost half, but they had such a great time in Chile. They were like super anxious to go back. But unfortunately, in their last season, they became a little too big for their britches and they lost the national championship, mostly because of overconfidence.
And rugby is, I'm terrible with sports. Rugby is like, it's very rough, right? Like, yes. There's like tackling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's, I feel like it's kind of like a mix between American football and like the other football, soccer. I feel like it's kind of like that, but yeah, there, it's rough.
Okay.
Yeah. Because of their loss, some of the club members didn't feel like they deserved to travel to Chile again. And so I guess a rugby club includes like competing team members, but then also like alumni and people who just kind of sponsor them. And it's kind of, I don't know, I kind of think it's like a country club type situation, but like around a sports team.
Okay.
I don't
know. It's like the team, like, and their posse.
Yes.
Okay.
Their wealthy posse, usually.
Okay.
The one funding them. So they didn't feel that the team deserved to go to Chile again. And, you know, they held all the money. So the team was trying to find a cheaper way, a cheaper alternative to get to Chile to play some rugby. To save some funds, they chartered a plane from the Air Force. Which I didn't think you could do, but I guess you can. And it costs about $1,600 US, and that's in 70s money. But still seems like, I mean, to charter an entire plane.
It had to be like a big plane for an entire rugby club.
Yeah. And so they began recruiting friends and family to help fill all 40 seats so that each passenger would only need to pay around $40.
Okay.
Yeah, which is not bad.
No. I know how this ends, but as someone who likes to travel, I'm like,
well, yeah, you know, $40.
Let me contact the Air Force.
So they're recruiting friends and family to help fill all these seats. And it wasn't until the day the funds were due that they finally had enough money to fill and enough people to fill the seats. So they were like cutting it real close. And one of the family members actually backed out at the last minute and canceled the last minute. And so a woman named Graziella Mariani bought the seat so that she could attend her oldest daughter's wedding.
No.
Yeah. So the aircraft carried 40 passengers and 5 crew members. So the pilot in command was Colonel Julio Cesar Ferradas, and he had accrued 5,117 flight hours and was a seasoned Air Force pilot. So he's in good hands, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's the freaking Air Force. Like, that's...
Yeah.
You can't do better than that, right?
Right.
I would assume.
Right. And so his co-pilot was Lieutenant Colonel Dante Hector Laguara. And on October 12th, 1972, the plane took off from Carrasco International Airport, bound for Santiago, Chile. However, they were forced to spend the night in Mendoza, Argentina, due to a storm front over the Andes. So they had to do an emergency land and spend the night in a different city.
Okay.
They hadn't yet made it over the Andes Mountains. There was a direct route from Mendoza to Santiago, but the high mountains require aircraft to fly at an altitude of 25,000 to 26,000 feet, which was kind of like the maximum operational ceiling that their aircraft could safely go. And so it was kind of dangerous for them to go that high, especially with, you know, a completely full plane, all 40 passengers, all of their luggage, you know, all of the fuel. It were way too heavy to even think about going that high.
Okay. I had to look. I just had to pull up a map of
South
America because I don't know where anything is.
Okay. Me either. Yeah. So they're in Argentina now, and they're trying to make it over to Santiago, Chile.
Okay.
So instead, they had to choose a longer 90-minute U-shaped route that would take them around the highest peaks of the Andes. So they're now going to take this alternate route. Weather also continued to be an issue. So conditions over the Andes had not improved that morning. But by the afternoon, things were predicted to shift. But everything that I have read suggests that if you don't leave in the morning, the air pressures, you know, from hot to cold, is not a good idea to go over the Andes at that time.
Okay.
If you leave in the afternoon. But on Friday, October 13th at 2:18 p.m., the plane took off, flying south. Once across the mountains in Chile, south of Curaçao, the aircraft was supposed to turn north and start its descent into Putahuel Airport, which was in Santiago. Supposed to. So their pilot, Ferradas, had flown over the Andes 29 times. But during the flight, he was training his co-pilot, who was in charge of the controls. And because of very heavy cloud cover, the pilots were flying under instrument meteorological conditions, which essentially means they're flying solely based on the readings of their instruments and not their visual field, because they can't see anything.
They can't see. Okay. Yeah.
So they're just going by what their instruments are telling. And they were flying at an altitude of 18,000 feet.
Okay.
So because of this, they really couldn't confirm their location with certainty. Mm-hmm. And at 3:21, LaGuardia contacted Santiago and notified air traffic controllers that he expected to reach Curaçao just a minute later. Normally, the flight from where they were to Curaçao takes 11 minutes. But the co-pilot informed Santiago that they were just past Curaçao and heading north in just 3 minutes.
Hmm.
So they're...
They don't know where they are.
They don't know where they are. No.
And now the airport thinks that they're somewhere else.
Yes. Okay. Exactly. Yes. The airport thinks they're somewhere else. And so the controller, not knowing that the flight was still over the Andes, authorized him to descend to 11,500 feet.
Dang.
Yeah. And that's kind of where everything goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
One of the teammates, Nando Parada, he recalls, quote, "Severe turbulence was tossing the plane around, and at one point we hit an air pocket that forced the plane to drop several hundred feet. This rapid descent dropped us below the clouds, and that was probably the moment when the pilots saw the black ridge rising dead ahead. They gunned the Fairchild F-227's engines in a desperate effort to climb. This effort managed to raise the plane's nose a few degrees, but their actions were too late to lift the plane completely over the mountain." So at 3:34, the lower part of the tail clipped the mountain at 13,800 feet. The next collision severed the right wing, which flew over the fuselage and severed the tail of the plane.
Oh my God.
So completely took off the tail. At the rear of the plane, the 30-year-old steward, Lieutenant Ramon Saul Martinez, the navigator, Orvido Ramirez, who was 26, and three of the boys on the team, Gaston Castamale, who was a 23-year-old law student, Alejo Huni was a 20-year-old vet student, and Guido Magri was a 23-year-old agronomy student. They were still strapped in their seats, and they were pulled out through the gaping hole in the back of the plane and fell to their death.
Oh, God.
Literally, like you see on, you know, TV, like there's a hole in the back of the plane and air sucking things out of it. Yes.
Okay. Horrifying. Yes. Absolutely horrifying.
Yeah. Just a few seconds later, Daniel Shaw, who was a 24-year-old cattle rancher, and Carlos Valletta, who was just 18 years old, fell out of the rear fuselage. Valletta somehow survived the fall.
Whoa.
From 11,000 feet.
What the fuck?
I mean, well, that was their altitude, so I don't know, you know, exactly how far away from the mountain they were, but he survived. But he stumbled down the snow-covered glacier and then fell into deep snow and was asphyxiated.
Oh, fuck.
I know. It's like, what are the odds? Ugh. Immediately afterward, due to another impact, the left wing was ripped from the body of the plane. So the plane's tail, wings, and a portion of the fuselage were missing, and the rest of it crashed and slid down the snow-covered mountain. Again, Nando says, quote, "The forces of the collision were huge. The Fairchild's nose was crumpled like a paper cup. In the passenger cabin, seats were ripped loose from the floor of the fuselage and hurled forward along with the people sitting in them and dashed against the cockpit bulkhead. Several passengers were crushed instantly as the rows of seats closed on them like the folds of an accordion, then tumbled into a mangled heap that filled the front of the fuselage." So this resulted in the death on impact of four other passengers. Sadly, the team physician, Dr. Francisco Nicola, could have used him.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And his wife, Esther Nicola. Eugenia Parado, who was Nando's mother. Mm. She died. And then Fernando Vasquez, who was a medical student. And finally, the plane fuselage came to rest on a glacier at an elevation of 11,710 feet in the Mendoza province of Argentina.
Oh, my God.
So,
it's kind of incredible that not more people died in impact.
Yeah. 28 people survived. No, 33 people. 33 people survived that first,
out of 40.
The crash. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
45 total because there was 5 crew.
That's
but
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I
and
would
also
not want to be one of them.
No. And also they had called, you know, the airport, and mm-hmm. so they think they're in Chile.
And they're still in Argentina.
Yeah. They haven't. Yeah.
Oh shit.
So the pilot, Ferradas, died instantly when the nose gear kind of compressed the instrument panel against his chest, forcing his head out of the window.
Oh, God.
I know. It gets bad. I'm real sorry.
Oh, God.
And the co-pilot was critically injured and was trapped in the crushed cockpit. One of the team members says that he was screaming for them to get his gun so he could just kill himself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, 33 of the 45 passengers and crew remained alive after the crash, though there were, of course, serious and significant injuries.
Of course.
Yes. Nando was unconscious due to a skull fracture, and he would remain unconscious for 3 days. And literally just like bits of – he could feel like bits of skull just like when he touched his head.
It was, oh, my God.
Bleh. Two of the other team members, Roberto Canessa and Gustavo Zerbino, were medical students. And they immediately began triaging survivors. So they just like kicked in, which is fascinating. If you're squeamish, I would skip ahead. Oh. This is not going to be, I mean, it's a plane crash. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. It's awful.
Oh, so Nando says, quote, "A 6-inch steel tube had impaled the stomach of a quiet stoic player named Enrique Platero. When Gustavo yanked the tube from his friend's gut, several inches of intestines came out. But Enrique immediately stuffed them back in and got to work helping others."
Jesus Christ.
What? He literally stuffed his intestines in. Just went to go help people.
I mean, I guess I could picture, like, if I could imagine stuffing them back in, because I think I would be like, nope, that didn't just happen. Nope.
Yes.
This is fine.
Totally. But just
I don't. But then I feel like I would pass out from shock, not be like, all right, what do you need me to do?
Yes. Yeah. The calf muscle on one of team members Rafael Echeverin's legs had been almost completely torn off the bone and was dangling around the front of his leg. Yeah. So Canessa and Zerbino, the med students, they're just triaging everybody, trying to help immediately, see who they can even help and who's just, you know, beyond help, sadly, which is terrible. The captain of the team, Marcelo Perez del Castillo, immediately took charge in organizing the group. So he tasked those who were uninjured with helping those who were, and he gave jobs to others, such as removing the dead and injured from the fuselage, which would help preserve the dead, as well as help numb the pain of the injured. So that was a really smart idea. He also had people clearing debris, giving them a place to, you know, be. I read a quote on a blog. I think the author of this blog is like a mountain climber, and he ranks different survival stories. And he said something really fascinating and commended Castillo for his very quick thinking and organization, because he said, quote, "Action dispels panic." And that's so true. Like, if you give someone a job, they can kind of focus on something and not completely just sit there freaking out.
Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, I can't even fathom. I walk into a messy room and like don't know where to start. I can't imagine looking at a plane wreck full of people who are dead and dying and being like, okay, this is what we need to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Okay. They quickly, of course, realized that there was no hope of being rescued until at least earliest the following day. Like, it's getting, you know, late afternoon. It's not going to happen. And so they had to survive the night in below freezing temperatures, literally on a glacier. So Marcelo and the other healthy individuals made room inside the fuselage so that the survivors might be as comfortable as possible. The healthier survivors got to work attempting to seal as many holes as possible and creating a wall of snow, luggage, and plane seats to help seal off the entirely exposed rear of the plane.
Oh, okay.
For the surviving, a long and hard night awaited. Most had never known cold, much less bone-numbing temperatures like those up in the Andes. And of course, they had not been in that altitude. So, I mean, you know, altitude sickness, even like the hardened athletes that they were, altitude, you know, feels like sucking through a straw. Yeah. So during the first night, five more people died. Co-pilot LaGuara succumbed to his injuries. Francisco Abel, Felipe Macarian, and Julio Martinez Lamas. And sadly, Graziella Mariani, the woman who took the ticket at the last minute. So that left 28 survivors. Of course, the elements weren't the only concern. Marcelo directed others in the group to gather up any food they could find scattered about the craft and began to very carefully ration it among the survivors. Unfortunately, there was not much. The only food found consisted of 8 chocolate bars, a tin of mussels, 3 small jars of jam, a tin of almonds, a few dates, candies, dried plums, and several bottles of wine. But that's it.
Yeah, they, they're going to a rugby game.
And it's a 3-hour flight. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
They don't need much, or so they thought.
Yeah. And they're all like dressed, you know, used to dress up to go on airplanes at that time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so there's, you know, in, you know, kind of nice street clothes. Certainly not for cold weather.
No, no.
So rations, of course, were very small. Nando, who regained consciousness 3 days after the crash, he remembers eating a single chocolate-covered peanut for 3 days. Like, he just kept it in his mouth and very slowly kept taking little bits of it for 3 days.
Oh, my God.
But Marcello continued giving people chores and responsibilities. He was the one who was kind of like, we are getting rescued. They are coming for us. We need to, like, you know, survive as long as we can because they are coming. Mm-hmm. One of the members, Fido Strouch, created a way to melt the snow using sheet metal from under the seats, which were then heated by the sun and then collected into empty wine bottles.
Oh, my God.
So smart. So they could have water. Because at first they attempted to eat the snow for water. Not great. No, it blisters in your mouth. I mean, just terrible. Strouch also improvised sunglasses using the pilot's sun visors to prevent snow blindness, which literally it's just snow. Like, there's nothing but snow. Mm-hmm. So that's a very real, you know, worry. The survivors pulled the wool out of the seats to use for warmth. You know, despite everything against them, though, the survivors were sure that rescue was imminent. They were just – they knew they were going to get rescued.
And did any of – who was left surviving, did anyone know whereabouts they might even be?
No.
They had no idea.
No. They just knew they were in the Andes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Because all they could see was snow and mountains covered in snow. So, like, at first, like, trying to go find something was not even an option. They had no idea where they were or, you know.
Yeah.
So they had no
the pilot, the co-pilot, and the navigator are all dead, right? Okay.
Yep. Yeah. So the flight was reported missing to the Chilean Air Search and Rescue Service, or SARS, within an hour because it didn't arrive.
Right.
And that afternoon, four planes conducted searches until dusk. SARS officers listened to radio transmissions and concluded that the aircraft had come down in one of the most remote and inaccessible areas of the Andes. And so they called on the Andes Rescue Group of Chile, or the CSA. On the second day, 11 aircraft from Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay searched for the down flight. The search area included the flight location, and a few aircraft flew near the crash sites.
Oh, God.
And the survivors saw them.
No.
Oh. And so they were elated. They wrote SOS in lipstick on the car, on the fuselage. They made a huge cross in the snow out of luggage, trying to get their attention, but they didn't see them.
No, well, I mean, I imagine you're looking for a white plane, right, in the snow, and everything else probably just looks like rocks from above.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dang. Oh.
But to see them and, oh, gosh. Yeah. To see the planes and then
heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. What I also find super fascinating is there's pictures of them because they found a disposable camera and like took pictures while they were out there surviving. So we can actually see, you know, what they had to do. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Documenting stuff is so important.
Yes.
So cool.
So is.
Yeah.
It's a heartbreaking picture of them like jumping up and down, so excited that like they see the airplane. I'm thinking that's when it is. God. It's like they see it and they think that they're being rescued and no. Mm-mm. So the harsh conditions gave searchers very little hope that they would find anyone alive.
Sure. Yeah, I wouldn't expect anyone to be alive.
No.
Which I'm sure, I mean, I know people, like, they look no matter what, but I feel like when you believe more in the possibility of someone being alive, like, I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not, but I feel like you would maybe look harder, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, if you're not, like, close with them or like connected with them, you know, you don't have that drive to find them no matter what, sort of, you know.
Yeah, or like you're looking for an airplane, like a shredded, destroyed airplane. You're not looking for people. SOS mm-hmm. or a sign made out of luggage.
Yeah.
Because yeah. you're not expecting anyone to have survived.
Absolutely. Yeah. So along with the camera, the team also found a transistor radio wedged under one of the seats, and they created an antenna from electrical cable. Like,
how?
I don't know
how to do anything. I have zero survival skills.
Oh, nothing. Oh. So they were actually able to hear bits and pieces of the rescue, like, mission. Like, they were hearing all of these snippets of, like, people are coming. Like, they're looking for us. But after 11 days, on October 21st, their survivors listened to the radio as, after searching for a total of 142 and a half hours, the searchers concluded that there was no hope and called off the search.
Oh, and they heard it.
They heard it.
So heartbreaking, because, like, it kills your hope. But mm-hmm. I mean, I guess then at that point, you know, like, okay, we've got to move. We've got to come up with a new plan, because yep. they're not looking for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do want to mention that same day, Nando's sister, who had been traveling with them, so his mother passed away. His sister, Susanna, was very injured, mm-hmm. and she died that day as well. Oh, so Nando. It's just not a good day.
No.
And so, again, up until this point, the survivors were convinced that they were going to be rescued, but now their focus shifted on surviving on their own and also looking at the possibility of finding their own help and their own rescue. Nando says, quote, "In those early days, we all believed that rescue was our only chance of survival, and we clung to that hope with an almost religious zeal. I never stopped praying for the arrival of our rescuers or for the intercession of God. But at the same time, the cold-blooded voice that had urged me to save my tears," he had mentioned in his, he wrote a memoir, and he mentions that when he learned that he woke from his coma and he learned that his mother had died, mm-hmm. he started to cry, but that there was a voice in his head saying, "Don't cry, you'll waste salt."
Oh, God.
And so he just, like, steeled himself.
Oh, God.
So that's what he's talking about. "The cold-blooded voice that had urged me to save my tears was always whispering in the back of my mind, 'No one will find us. We will die here. We must make a plan. We must save ourselves.'" So, by the end of the first week, the last of their rations had been handed out. Mm-hmm. Again, there's no vegetation, no animals at that altitude. A very real possibility of starvation began to creep in. Nando writes in his memoir called "Miracle in the Andes, 72 Days on the Mountain and My Long Trek Home." "At high altitude, the body's caloric needs are astronomical. We were starving in earnest with no hope of finding food, but our hunger soon grew so voracious that we searched anyway. Again and again, we scoured the fuselage in search of crumbs and morsels. We tried to eat strips of leather torn from pieces of luggage, though we knew that the chemicals they'd been treated with would do us more harm than good. We ripped open seat cushions hoping to find straw, but found only inedible upholstery foam. Again and again, I came to the same conclusion. Unless we wanted to eat the clothes we were wearing, there was nothing here but aluminum, plastic, ice, and rock."
Jeez, there's just nothing. There's mm-mm. nothing.
No. Roberto Canessa, who was one of the medical students who had assisted with the injuries, he writes in his book, "I Had to Survive," quote, "Our common goal was to survive, but what we lacked was food. We had long since run out of the meager pickings we'd found on the plane, and there was no vegetation or animal life to be found. After just a few days, we were feeling the sensation of our own bodies consuming themselves just to remain alive. Before long, we would become too weak to recover from starvation. We knew the answer, but it was too terrible to contemplate. The bodies of our friends and teammates, preserved outside in the snow and ice, contained vital, life-giving protein that could help us survive. But could we do it?"
Oh,
I know.
God.
There's you can say, you know, I would never do that. But then in that situation, like,
you would do it.
You would do it.
You would do it. Yeah. What a, I mean, what a waste not to.
Right.
What do you gain from
right
dying of starvation?
Right.
You can, Haley, if anything ever happens, you can totally eat me. It's fine.
Same. Same. Okay.
I don't care. I will not be there.
Right. Right. Which is kind of funny because Nando recalls a conversation with one of his teammates, Carlitos, and he remembered saying, "We are going to starve here. I don't think the rescuers will find us in time. I know it and you know it, but I will not die here. I will make it home." Carlitos asked if he meant he was going to climb out, and when Nando replied that he wanted to, Carlitos reminded him that he was too weak from starvation. Nando said, quote, "There is plenty of food here, but you must think of it only as meat. Mm-hmm. Our friends don't need their bodies anymore." Carlito softly replied that he had been thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
And the group joined hands and pledged that if they were to die, they wanted the others to use their body for food. Canessa says, quote, "For a long time we agonized. I went out in the snow and prayed to God for guidance. Without his consent, I felt I would be violating the memory of my friends, that I would be stealing their souls. We wondered whether we were going mad, even to contemplate such a thing. Had we turned into brute savages, or was this the only sane thing to do? Truly, we were pushing the limits of our fear." So the team is Catholic, like very Catholic. And many of them feared that doing this would condemn them to damnation. Like they were very scared. But eventually, even the most devout among them took comfort in the thought that, kind of in a similar fashion to how they derived spiritual strength from communion, they were kind of drawing life from the bodies of their friends. So they started to think of it as communion.
Okay.
And so at that point, they kind of all agreed this had to happen. Roberto Canessa, he found shards of glass and gathered three assistants, and he went to the graves. He writes, quote, "I will never forget that first incision 9 days after the crash. Each man alone with his conscience on that infinite mountaintop on a day colder and grayer than any before since. Four of us, Gustavo, Fido Strouch, my dear friend Daniel Masbones, and me. All of us with a razor blade or shard of glass in his hand, carefully cutting the clothes off a body whose face we could not bear to look at. We laid the thin strips of frozen flesh aside on a piece of sheet metal. Each of us finally consumed our piece when we could bear it." And Nando recalls, after being handed a piece of the dead, quote, "It was grayish white, as hard as wood, and very cold. I reminded myself that this was no longer part of a human being. This person's soul had left his body. Still, I found myself slow to lift the meat to my lips. I avoided meeting anyone's gaze, but out of the corners of my eyes, I saw the others around me. Some were sitting like me with the meat in their hands, summoning the strength to eat. Others were working their jaws grimly. Finally, I found my courage and slipped the flesh into my mouth. It had no taste. I chewed once or twice, then forced myself to swallow. I felt no guilt or shame. I was doing what I had to do to survive." Over the next few days, the survivors continued their chores, which now include processing the meat of the dead. They eventually started to dry the meat in the sun, which made it more palatable. Okay. And when the supply of flesh was diminished, they would also eat the hearts, lungs, and brains. So they were very cautious of using the entire body. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't want anything to go to waste.
Sure. They have no idea how long they'll need it.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've been there for 2 weeks now. There's, you know, they now know no one's coming. And unfortunately, it's about to get worse.
Ooh. Oh, my God. Wow. Okay. Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm very excited that you are doing this one, because like I said, it's been on my list. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely a hard one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really it was Yellow Jackets.
Oh. Ooh.
Yeah. It's just such a good show. Oh my gosh, it's so good.
Okay, I'll have to try it. I'll have to try it. I need to do Showtime for at least like a few months because I am. No, it's not Showtime. It's
Outlander. Showtime.
Outlander Stars. Oh, that's what I was just stars. Thinking. I need to get caught up on Outlander, but that's Stars. There's too many. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's too many services.
Yeah, that's why we keep rotating. So we have Showtime this month.
We should do that too. Wow. Okay. Well. Dang.
Sorry.
It's okay. These boys are incredible.
My gosh. Read. I skimmed. two of their memoirs. For this, and they. I think one of them wrote it himself, but another had like you know an author help him out. Mm-hmm. But the way they describe everything is just, they're fantastic writers.
I know that there's so much more that they go through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Yep, yeah. They still have so much more.
I know. Yeah. They have a lot more.
Yeah. This is a great topic.
All right. That is where we're going to leave you. Please stay tuned next week. Next Wednesday for part two of Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 to find out what happens to our survivors. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Reference Desk.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/thereferencedesk.
And if you're interested in purchasing any of the books we discussed today, visit our bookshop storefront at bookshop.org/thereferencedeskpod.
You can find us on Instagram at thereferencedeskpod, visit our website at thereferencedeskpod.com, or drop us an email at referencedeskpod@gmail.com.
This episode was written and produced by us.
Our music is C'est Salavi by Eric Harper, and our cover art for the show is by Maria Amaya.
Until next week, we'll see you in the stacks.